Welcome to episode 57 of Sound Out Wave, the first podcast to reach planet Earth from Cybertron. I'm Nell, and I'm great at Transformers.
And I'm Greg, and I suck at Transformers.
And I'm James, and I write Transformers.
And this week, we've accomplished something.
Well done, you two. Now, this is you have achieved something. You've achieved something times 57.
Wow. That's right.
You've achieved 57 things. That's right. yeah. So for anyone, I figure a good number of people are going to be tuning in for the first time right here, just because, you know, people who already read the comic, why would they want to listen to other people read the comic? But you, obviously people like you. So our show, this is Sound Out Wave. It's nice to meet you, all of those people.
Yeah.
Good to see
happy
you.
Happy to have
for
you.
For everyone who knows this already. This is James Roberts, if you're not familiar. He is the writer of More Than Meets the Eye, which we have briefly mentioned on the show before.
A few times.
Thank you.
And the writer of Lost Light, which is coming out in December, which is, the continuation of More Than Meets the Eye. I feel like we cover that every time we mention it, just to make sure if there's any sort of uncertainty,
yes,
clear it up.
Yes, remove all ambiguity, because you never know. I worry about it. You know. I still get questions about whether there's a connection between the two series and whether one picks up from the rest. So yes, you can reiterate that as much as you like.
Good, and that's why we're here, to help.
And not only that, but for anyone who didn't read all of More Than Meets the Eye, shame on you. But go ahead and just pick up Lost Light number one. It's a great jumping on point.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the impression I'm getting.
That's definitely the line we're taking. No, it is. It was a very, very hard issue to write, actually, because it had to be a jumping on point, and it also had to be faithful to the 57 issues and whatever that came before. It had to be a continuation and a new start. So we'll see.
Sure.
I think it worked out okay. We'll see.
I'm excited to see.
Judge that. So don't get too confident.
Once it's released into the wild, then who knows?
I'm very excited. And I know our show started when there was a giant bundle of Transformers comics, and Nell asked me to pick them up because I don't know anything about Transformers. There was recently another bundle. The show is very devoted to, like, if you're listening, just go ahead and start reading Transformers. You'll be fine.
It's not scary, and if it ever gets a little scary, we're here to help you.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
You're performing a very important public service.
we try
get all that tax money, we love it.
You're paid well enough to do this, we all know that.
So I do have formal questions here. I'm gonna go ahead and jump in, and I'll just start it off easy. Who is the best character in Transformers, and why is it Whirl?
Well, you know, I don't think you're alone in thinking that. Whirl remained one of the best characters to write, actually. And I don't know, he casts a long shadow over the series, doesn't he, really? Because he's not in it a huge amount. But in season two, anyway, when he does crop up, it tends to be for significant reasons. I'm glad you like him. No, he's
absolutely.
He's some of the characters' voices are easier. I can hear them more clearly than others. And Whirl is, to me, very distinctive in terms of obviously what he'd sound like, but also the things he'd do, the decisions he'd make. And he looks amazing. He looks very distinctive.
Yeah, what a great design.
Yeah, Nick really. I think did a good job there, for sure.
And working in the Empyrada and all these things in New Astralion was really interesting. My story with Whirl is my favorite character. Whirl is my favorite Transformer, bar none. And the reason for that is actually really strange, because in the very, very beginning, we get this impression of Whirl as like a deeply unstable individual, and that's never really changed, but it's sort of changed in tone. Yeah. Like, when we first meet Whirl, it's very dark, and he's hanging around all these corpses and everything, and he has this very violent confrontation with Cyclonus, and I thought, I don't think I'm supposed to like this character, so I'm just going to throw everybody for a loop and really just invest in this one. And fortunately, it paid off. Like, Whirl is the most fun of any character, I think.
Yeah, you put all your chips on him. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's right, because you're not. It pays to remember for me that actually, yeah, in the very beginning, there really isn't anything. There isn't any sliver of light really in his character.
Right. Because really. Even when he shows up, of course, in the ongoing issues that you wrote, he's like, that's where we see his confrontation with Megatron, and it's obviously there's no reason to like him in those issues either. So when
just straightforwardly, he's just a brutalist, isn't he, really? And,
And
as you say, then, yeah, we see him in issue one, and he's about to...
he's destroying the sweeps,
commit suicide and all that. And then then we set up his antagonistic relationship with Cyclones. And even in issue three, when he's when the Spark Eater's loose, really, he's...
oh, God, yeah.
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 Yeah, so he doesn't really. Yeah, it's been a satisfying from my perspective. It's been satisfying seeing him slowly recalibrate. Really,
That's actually another question I have, which is like, was his arc? And again, this applies to like the larger book in total. How much is planned ahead of time, and how much room do you allow yourself for improv to sort of say to be surprised by the characters and plot turns?
And I'm very meticulous when it comes to the raw plot.
Sure.
So, you know, I know certain events need to happen at certain times. And less so when it comes to character. Well, yeah, I don't know. With there's certain characters you think, okay, I need them to end up here, I know that this individual or these two will, you know, by the time we're X issues in, they need to be in a different place for these reasons. But I found it easier to leave more wriggle room around sort of the character stuff, unless it's intrinsically linked to a plot point.
Sure.
Then I prefer to give it a bit of room to breathe. And actually, Whirl, I mean, I think we're going way, way back. I don't know whether Whirl was originally going to survive beyond Remain in Light, because you know that scene when he gets pushed, when he apparently gets pushed into the smelting pool.
Right. Oh my God.
I mean. By the time I came to write that, I knew, of course, he wasn't going to die. But I mean, you know, way, way back, maybe even in the sort of planning stages, I thought, okay, well, that the end point of that plot between Whirl and Cyclonus would be Whirl dying. But you know, as I say, very early on, abandoned that because he was becoming too much fun to write.
Absolutely, yeah. There's so much you can do with him.
Yeah, and yeah, I've said before, Swerve came to the fore in a way which wasn't anticipated. So. It's probably quite selfish, really. It's the characters that have a strong voice and that you enjoy writing about, that you find more things for them to do. And then, you know, you've got stuff like Megatron where you need to know very clearly where you're going with that.
Yeah, his arc is very much like the content of season two.
Yeah, it's the sort of spine that runs through the 20 issues, 25 issues, yeah. Mm. But no, I mean, people like, you know, characters like Whirl and you know, you could say Rodimus as well, Brainstorm as well, the sort of chaotic characters.
Sure.
whether that's literally chaotic or irresponsible or selfish, you know, they're often the sort of the engine for the plot, really.
They're
so they're useful to have around
for all kinds of events.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're triggers, really.
So speaking of Swerve, who's even in a very funny book, very much a comic relief character, to me, he kind of sums up what the books are about. Is it's a very sitcom feel. It's very.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's just like, but yeah, he's the most like meta aware of the fact, like, or the things that he says. I don't know how to word it, but yeah, like he's
kind of
the audience's reminder. He's almost speaking on behalf of the people reading it. Like,
right. We get to look through his eyes a lot.
But then I think also like it's the readers. He's kind of speaking for the readers, but then in a way he speaks for you, James, as the writer, because there are times when like it's very clear you're aware of what the story is doing and what's happening and how it sounds. And
I think that
works really well.
Well, yeah, I've had to try and be careful with it because you know, I don't want Swerve to become, you know, too much like Abed, you know, in Community, because that's hugely tempting, but also it'd be very you know, hackneyed to do it. And I think when I chose Swerve to be the voice of the recap pages, you know, that really sort of cemented his position as sort of the narrator, or sort of the outsider looking in. But he is useful. Yes, I admit it is useful when you want to sort of lampshade certain things. Again, without getting too arbit about it. Interestingly, I mean, everything you've said in terms of his the role he plays is accurate, but I don't know if he's as jokey a character nowadays as he used to be. You know, I mean, I haven't done this. I'm not trying to make a point. I'm wondering out loud whether if you went through season two and sort of looked at his appearances. It's probably more tragic than comedic, actually. Right. He's either having he's either sort of in his room and projecting hologramatic avatar or something, or he's feeling guilt or angst over his treatment of Ten, really. So it's
right, and I think
that's my point.
But no, I think you're right, and I think it kind of just further though serves the same idea in the fact that he I mean, it's kind of like when you have. Like, I don't know. I know a lot of comedians are actually, you know, they come out later and say that they're actually depressed, or like they deal with depression. So I think in learning more, like it's just the more we learn about Swerve, the more you see past this front he puts out where he is very funny and everything is very lighthearted, which is just, I mean, that's a natural thing that happens in real life too, when you get to know somebody better. And I feel like that's the side of Swerve that we get to see more in season two. Absolutely.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, we started looking in that direction with the annual, but yeah, as you say, we didn't really dive into it until season two. And he's either been having his own sort of crisis, existential or otherwise, or he's been, you know, terrified, you know, being on Necro World things and having the DJD around the corner. So he's had a time of it. I also liked, you know, just more generally because. You tend to there's always somewhere like Swerve's in an ensemble sitcom or drama, really, that there's sort of a meeting point, and where it's a bar, the generically you tend to get the barman is the wise one, you know, the dispenser of wisdom, and I thought, well, no, let's just have him being a sarcastic little git, really, you know, it takes the piss out of people.
It works perfectly. And, like, even just having the bar on the last light, I think it just goes in hand in hand with everything else that I think makes this title so easy to pick up and appreciate and relate to these characters.
Like,
because
my thinking is even for all of these giant grand plots like Elegant Chaos and everything, it seems to be a book very much about the smaller moments, the kind of like, what are these guys doing when they're not having a 4 million year war? And was it conceived that way, or is that just natural to the way that you write?
It's probably turned out to be the latter. I mean, in terms of conceiving the feel of the series, I knew I wanted to have an ensemble cast, because, I mean, Beast Wars aside, when I was putting this together, I thought to myself, really, you know, there hasn't been a Transformers series in any medium, really, that's followed the adventures of a group, like almost like a super team, you know. Sure. Well, not a super team in terms of like their Avengers abilities or whatever, but yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that led, and of course I was a huge Justice League International fan, and this all led to Nick's cover on issue one. So I in terms of the shape and feel of the book, I wanted a group book, and I wanted it to be perhaps more lighthearted than people were expecting after Chaos Theory.
But I just find, and also, you've
mentioned now sort of the sitcom thing. I wanted it to be, I'm fascinated by the way sitcoms are put together, good sitcoms, and the economy of plot, really, you know, the way that, well, you've got to establish the characters quickly and cleanly. And yes, they need to be slightly larger than life in some cases. But it's a really quick, direct route to the heart of the audience, really. I think more people, well, as many people fall in love with sitcoms and become attached to characters in good sitcoms as they do in sort of serious dramas. So if you're talking an ensemble group with sort of a comedic overtones, then you really are in sitcom territory. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, just before we spoke, I was watching my eldest son and I are catching up on Parks and Recreation, you know, because we didn't see any of that, so we're now nearly at the end of season.
I'm so excited.
Two, you know? Well, exactly, yeah, this is it, you see, and
it's so good.
And it is, and it's up there with Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Community, and the, you know, the very good the very good group sitcoms, where particularly in Parks and Rec, actually, you know, I was just saying to my son, you know, the plots are so I don't mean this as a criticism, but they're so mundane on paper.
Sure. Yeah.
And yet, you know, the stakes are are as high as they would be in any other, you know.
Yeah.
You can have, and that's why back to More Than Meets the Eye, you know, I really enjoy writing issues like issue 40, when Ratchet left, for example, where, you know, that no one throws a punch in that issue. And the stakes are, you know, how one character is going to say, okay, guys, as he's not dying or anything. He's just going away for a bit. But it was as real to me, or I was invested in that issue as much as I was, you know, dying of the light in a way.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's absolutely like the thing that I think so many people cherish about More Than Meets the Eye specifically is, like, obviously there's a huge history of Transformers comics with great action and all kinds of thrills and twists and things like that. But it's rare to get, as far as I know, again, this is where I started. I'm under the impression that it was rare to really dig into who these characters are and how they feel about things and how they interact with each other.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, certainly to the extent that we do it in More Than Meets the Eye. Yes. And in that sense, I was very lucky that, you know, it launched, it was a post-war title, you know, that it came about. Absolutely. Along with John's title. You know, I was, as you were asking the question, I was just thinking to myself, would I have been able to tell these type of stories if it was, you know, if it was the normal backdrop of Autobots versus Decepticons? And probably not, because you could have the occasional quiet episode, but there'd always be this sort of idea that, you know, isn't there a war going on? You know,
why isn't anybody shooting?
Exactly. Yeah. Why is everyone preoccupied with two rival bars? You know. It's I guess it's a lucky confluence of of events, really. You know, so the fact that we decided to end the war, and the sort of freedom that gave us, and a very sympathetic IDW and Hasbro, who were very encouraging and saying, you know, yeah, tell those type of stories, and in fact, you know, just run with it. So, you know, go as far as you like. So
I'm so glad. That's what we've done.
And I think it's really attracted a fan base that, for the most part, is a lot of people aren't into the action fighting type things, and they're just very invested in the emotional component of what the story is. And I don't mean to undermine things that are wildly structured, because obviously you have a lot of fun figuring out structures to tell these stories in.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's got a sort of a heavy plot scaffold,
right?
It's often, hopefully, well, the idea is that's used to create space to tell more intimate stories. If you're looking for huge scraps, then it's probably not the title for you. There is action, and I'm not quite as clinical as thinking, okay, then, you know, what's the fight going to be this issue? But right. I think nearly every issue there is some physical conflict. There's some, you know, it just tends to be either over quite quickly, which some people would say, yeah, it's over too quickly, or it's not the main event. You know, it's rarely
about the fight.
Yeah, that's right. There's not been many stories which hinge on which one of these characters is going to win that fight.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, that does happen with like DJD and Megatron and all these sorts of things.
Yeah, that's probably the most old-fashioned story in that sense. You know, it does.
Sure.
It does,
yeah.
It pivots on A versus B, really. Mm.
Yeah, I felt very, very Rio Bravo, like Magnificent Seven, hold the fort down.
Oh, yes.
Thing.
God,
yes,
so good.
That's absolutely. It was very much Zulu inspired, which is why there's that line actually of Swerve's when he phones Lottie, you know, and he's saying, oh, you know, there's patients thousands of them, which is a lift from the film. So when he's talking about Zulus. I don't know. I can't tell you the character name, but yes, it's originally, you know, Zulus, thousands of them.
There you go. That's an exclusive scoop, everybody.
Oh yeah, and that's why Blue Streaks put Zulu on in issue 30 or whatever it is.
You know? Right. Yeah, I remember them watching it.
Yeah. So a little, whatever that is, foreshadowing, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Well, and obviously these books are just full of things like that. Which I have to say, even when Greg and I prepare for episodes, I never know how long it takes you, Greg, to prepare. Because I think for the most part, you would just read the books and then
I'm
be
very
like ready
fortunate
to go.
In that my whole shtick is like, I don't know anything about any of this.
Whereas, like, I would, particularly with More Than Meets the Eye, I would, like, have the books, and I have, like, my notebook, so I can be, like, paying attention and be like, okay, wait, I do remember this is a callback to... It would take me easily twice as long, I think, on weeks with More Than Meets the Eye to make sure and, like, hope I'm getting those kinds of things that get just written into the issues. Because there's so much, and that's the stuff that makes it really impressive. I mean, not that it's not impressive otherwise, but I'm a detail person, and I love those little things, and I like finding them and pointing them out. It's fun for me to share, and like when I get to share them even with like Greg on the air, and it'll be like a bit of a surprise.
And it's well, nice when I can pick up things too. I saw you talking on Twitter the other day to Kieran Gillen talking about Phonogram, and I was like, oh, this is that scene where they're all sitting around listening to me, the dance night and all these sorts of things.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very Phonogram little bit there.
Absolutely, yeah, you're right. That was directly inspired by that and Mean Girls and things, that type of type of stuff.
So where is it? Is it just the collection of your influences, or are there particular things where you think this is directly, like, you can draw a line between this and More Than Meets the Eye?
I think, well, just Justice League International was the first comic. Sure. This was 1986-87, wasn't it? It was the first comic I read. When I read it, I'd not read anything like it before. But yeah, there's quite a strong tradition in British comics in the late 70s and 80s for to be sort of darkly humorous, black humor and 2000 AD type Judge Dredd and that type of thing. But it wasn't that type of humor, it was a sort of back and forth sort of bantery thing. But it also, and it's only really when I've gone back and reread them, there was a knowingness, and it wasn't smug, but there was a sort of an element of self-awareness. You sort of, not that these characters knew they were in a comic, but it played with sort of the conventions of comic book stories or superhero stories, at least. So that was an eye-opener. Obviously the weekly Transformers comic I've said before was, that's really what got me into them, into comics and into Transformers in the first place. So Simon Furman's writing on that, the raw continuity, Simon would tell stories that took 2 years to unfold. And that was thrilling as a kid, because two years as a kid is like 40 years anyway, as an adult. What else? And then, outside of comic books, TV and films, I purposely avoided name checking this or referencing this too much in the early days, because it is such an obvious influence. I didn't want people to think I was sort of slavishly trying to ape this show, but the British sitcom Red Dwarf has a lot of similarities in terms of tone, and even in terms of setup, really. I mean, Red Dwarf is set on a very, very small group of characters, but they're sort of essentially trapped together on this ship. The very loose quest, which is getting back to Earth, and it's just things happening to them, and they're all absolute losers, really. And it's just and you root for them, because you think, really, even the smallest challenge or the most minor adversary to them is going to be, hugely difficult to defeat or overcome, and somehow they do it. And so that sort of sensibility informed More Than Meets the Eye as well. But I guess most of all, with More Than Meets the Eye, it was in the act of telling the stories and feeling the series take off that helped gave it shape, really. It found its own voice, I think, or I found my own voice as we went along. I'm not saying it took 3 years, but by the time issue 6 Interiors came out, and I thought, okay, I know where we are now. I've got the feel for how these characters are with each other. And actually, the very first inkling of that I got was when I wrote the scene in issue 3 when they're gathered around the Duobot's body and the Spark Eater's eating his brain. And they're sort of, that's the first proper scene they've got, where you spent 3 issues bringing them together. And there's about 7 or 8 characters bouncing off each other, and I think, this has got some legs if it's handled properly. Then people might want to spend time with these characters for a while.
I love
that. That's interesting to hear you say that, because I never even thought of it. But then hearing you say it, I'm like, you're right. I remember even the first time I was reading issue 3, and it's just the way that they're talking, because even I think it's Rewind. One of them, they lay out exactly what happened to him, and Rewind raises his hand to ask if he can go home now. And it's something like that. And I hadn't thought about it, but I think that was really a moment that it's initially endeared me, for sure, to these characters. Well, and also because they're not all like main characters. Like a lot of people, even if you're very familiar with Transformers, there's a good chance you don't know who Brainstorm is, and you don't know who all these characters who now we all care about very much. Like initially they were.
I mean, you should be proud of that, because to me, these guys are who the Transformers are. Like, Bumblebee, Starscream, they're fine, but these guys, they're the real main characters.
That's lovely to hear, I was thinking about, as you were talking, I was thinking that, looking back at the first year of writing it, the moments when I felt most, carried along with it, or all the possibilities of it, of the story, were the issues that were sort of added in, because... The Shadow Play came about. Shadow Play was an additional story, which came about at the behest of Hasbro, because they were anxious that Optimus Prime wasn't too far removed from either my title or John's. So John, so that's where John's synchronicity, I think, and the attendant stories of his came in, and my equivalent was Shadow Play. So that was a three-parter that was not in the original plan. The original sort of 12 issue breakdown from All the Meets the Eye. The annual was a late, unexpected additional commission as well. And issue one. Was issues one and two, the events in issues one and two, with some sort of significant omissions, was just one issue, and the decision was taken spread it out a bit and take a bit more time. And so I remember sitting down and writing just the first scene in issue two with Brainstorm, and talking on the phone about the mashed up robot. That was almost like a bone. Okay, so I felt like I've been given a bonus opportunity to go and put more words in these characters' mouths. So that and the annual. And I remember I was on a train to into London, and I was just thinking the very beginnings of Shadow Play, and it was just the idea of them sitting around the table in swerves and just talking nonsense, really. And I thought, it's as I say, these characters could be around for a while.
Sure, it'd be fun to hang out with these guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So in that respect, then, like specifically regarding Shadow Play, I know, and I might not be remembering correctly, because I do have the script for issue six, I believe. Wait, is that the one? Yes. Six, Interiors, you just brought it up. And in it, I remember being surprised while I was reading the script, because Fortress Maximus is killed initially in the script.
Yes,
So was Shadow Play, like the fact that obviously Rung is the one who gets shot in that one instead, did Shadow Play influence that, or?
I think I'd already decided that Fort Max shouldn't die. So it wasn't a case
Thank you.
See, I mean, clearly some people think I'm bad enough as it is, but I was far worse in the beginning. I penciled in about 60% of deaths, didn't I? Really?
Oh, God.
World was going to go. And,
if you knew how many I've saved, you'd really.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You should be thanking me. So I think it was. I think it was just a case of Fort Max. Because originally, he was. As you would have seen in the script, he was going to die, and they were going to call the ship wasn't going to have a name until he died, and they were going to call it the Maximus.
Oh, wow.
So I mean, so you can tell that was all those things were written down before the script for issue one was even written. So
I just didn't know because obviously in that one Rung doesn't get. So I wasn't sure if because obviously the reason they're all standing around talking is so that they can fix Rung's brain.
Yes. I think maybe it could have been as simple as he would have got shot and then we would have jumped to. It would have been a case of him having his head slowly rebuilt and Red Alert coming, speaking to him, giving him the thumb drive and stuff, and we would have just jumped over the. But Shadow Play was, as I say, a bonus story, but it enabled me to sort of consolidate some of the plot points in Chaos Theory, and therefore build a better set of foundations for Elegant Chaos. Really, Elegant Chaos wouldn't have happened without Shadow Play.
So there's so much.
Yeah,
it all just like informs itself.
It does.
Things like Swerve and his injury, and if you go back to the Chaos Theory issues, he's got the patch on his arm. Like it, even things to that degree just kind of blow my mind. When like you get there and then you go back, and you're like, oh yeah, there it is. It was he had some form of this planned out. It's very impressive.
And I know that Nell has the scripts and can see these things. How much do you give to the artist? I know it's a very dialogue heavy comic, and how much do you say this is something you need to put in there, or this is have fun with this and do whatever you want? Like, what is the sort of the structure of the script?
It's a full script as opposed to right. the Marvel. So it's detailed. In fact, it's very detailed, and I suppose if I'm criticized by any artist that works with me, it's going to be because you know they're saying, look, can you trust me to do this, or give me some space, please.
You're going to Alan Moore right now.
Well, exactly. Yeah, they sort of, you know, just, you know, let me. But it's two things. One is that, as you say, it's very dialogue driven, but it also tends to be a very densely packed comic book. Right. Each issue, there's a lot happening, and so to be honest,
we have noticed.
So my first concern is proving to my editor that, you know, that it can, it, you know, this will fit in the issue. So
right.
It'll be a case of, you know, page one. Tier one, panel one, and so on. I need to, you know, prove to myself and to others that actually, yes, these events can fit in this issue. But then, yes, as you said, the other reason, of course, is that there's a lot of visual clues, there's a lot of foreshadowing and stuff. Right. So we need to make sure that certain things are grounded in the panel or present in the panel. We're talking about you know, Rung being ill and things like that. I think that's the scene where, that's right, Red Alert goes to see him and mentions Overlord by name.
Yeah.
And then the little medical drone in the background, yeah. You know, his eye lights up.
Like,
and then
we, up.
That's right. And then that's issue 8 or 7. And it's not till issue 14, I think, that we, you know, through Chrome Dome's Nemo surgery, that we see that, you know, that drone's been programmed to record any, you know, many mention of Overlord's name and stuff. So yeah, so certain things are important, and like, you know, the moment where Skid's nudge gun is swiped, you know, by Chrome Dome again. So yeah, it's important we capture those things. But Alex, you know, it's certainly not a case that you can't be trusted to do things well. You know, where there is space for him to intuit things or improvise, then he'll run with it and it'll always be brilliant. So it's not that I don't trust him or Jack on the first arc of the new series, you know.
Certainly, no, Alex kills it. I think, I mean, all the artists that we're very lucky to have, I think, just all of the everyone working on these books that we have.
I don't think there's a bad looking issue.
No, that's not in this and not in ongoing, like everything is really right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Alex will add, I mean, it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. Alex will add extra things. He'll bring another layer of sort of story logic to it, and he'll sort of say, well, you know, let's position this here because that will line up well with this, or, you know, I've drawn this character in the background because, you know, or these two characters. Often he'll say, particularly as the series went on and we sort of both got into the cat's cradle of interrelationship dynamics, he's sort of saying, yeah, well, those two people are talking in the background because. You know, not that we ship, but it wasn't ever as explicit as that. But
well, maybe this is the show to talk about them.
Absolutely,
talk about those ships.
What
implicit ships that Alex and I have?
Right. Well, and on that subject, like, again, going back to the ideas that these are all about the sort of non-fighting moments, things like Conjunx Endura and Amakin Endura. As far as I know, those are really inventions by you. Like, it's very much you who brought the ideas of romance to this series in some capacity, at least.
Yeah, and that stems from, and it's always been, I've always wanted to know more about how their world clicks together and what makes it. You know, when I was a reader in the 80s, God, the stuff I'd pounce upon would be, you know, sometimes just throw away details, you know, background information or just a bit of color, you know, like, you know, units of time or the name of the names of cities or stuff like that. Because it just all added to the tapestry. And so particularly in a post-war series, you know, you've got free rein to explore the non conflict related details of their society, whether that's romance or religion or I say the economy. We haven't done much around that, but certainly politics.
Right.
You know, we can have some fun doing that, even if, you know, and not every, as I say, not every reveal has to be integral to the plot. it just gives you a better sense of the world within in which they operate.
Right. Absolutely. It makes it more realistic. It makes it.
Yeah, I think I want you to know the fan base very, very much appreciates those details of like, okay, this is the ritual involved with these things. Yeah. This is how this works.
That's interesting, the phrasing, because I do like the rules part of it too. As I like to sort of think, okay, if it's a ritual or a process or, you know, I don't know, something about that, it helps to make sense of things. Yeah, if it could be very, sometimes, you know, it's good to be nebulous and to be vague and ambiguous, but sometimes you think, actually, you know, as in real life, you know, there's a process, there's an A to B to C, and we're going to spell it out. Because then, you know, it's there for anyone else to pick up and use and have fun with, whether writers or fans, you know.
And it seems so well thought out that, like, this, so many times when we get to those things, it makes sense. Like, oh, of course, given the what we know about Cybertronian culture, that's obviously how this would work and those sorts of things.
Right. Well, that's good to hear. I mean, I think it's sort of it's a process of accretion, really, isn't it? Because, you know what's gone, you know, if you've invented it or not, but you know what's gone before and you think, okay, well, I'm going to build on that and take it further. And you know, sometimes it's just a happy coincidence if they're complementary details. But other times, you know, you're sort of encouraged to move in a certain direction because of stuff you've already established. So, and it's like, you know, the Condrix Endura, when I conceived of that, I didn't think at the time, oh, there'll be a friendship equivalent. But it's sort of, there's a logic to it, which sort of, you know, takes you down that path, you know.
Sure, it made sense given situations and things.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Hmm.
And yeah, we have really appreciated that. It's a great shorthand for shipping and like, oh, well, these are Amica, but these are conjuncts and things like that.
it establishes, it makes it seem like it's rooted and it has, like, it's just something that they all understand. And that's how society works. Like, there are just cultural cues that we all know. Yes. And I think by giving that to these characters, this other species, then we have... It just makes them more realistic and more relatable.
Yeah, and actually, that's a word you used it, and I hadn't yet. But you know, culture and culturally—that's a better word than society. Actually, it's about giving them some cultural depth. I think that's the enticing part. I think that's the and the exciting part for me at writing it. What goes on in between the fight scenes, basically? You know,
right?
Right. Like, and honestly, I know, I feel like I must have said this to you before, like when you and I have talked, but it's just like, these are really the kind of stories I always wanted from Transformers. I wanted, like, I'm, you know, I've watched Generation One and I've watched, you know, the different series that have come before this. I've read the series, the IDW books that have come before these ones. But yeah, I like it. I like when, you know, there's a moment to breathe and we get to know more about the characters between all the action. And then, yeah, you and even starting in Last Stand of the Wreckers, with you and Nick writing that, we were starting to see what now we get fully in More Than Meets the Eye.
Oh yeah. Well, that's good too. And I think I'm a beneficiary really of the fact that, you know, this came, More Than Meets the Eye came in what, 25 years ish into the franchise. I don't think it's something
that'll
which,
help.
It couldn't have been the first thing out the gate. You know, people. Yeah, many other aspects.
It would have been
aspects.
A different thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have. But you know, 25 years in, Transformers. You know, they've sort of they're a pop cultural event in themselves. That they're sort of a shared memory of or understanding of what they're about, and different iterations have explored different aspects. Mainly war related. So yeah, I think the time was right. That it was mature enough as a franchise to accommodate something like this, maybe.
Speaking of that, I did some research. Like, as soon as I started reading these and really enjoying More Than Meets the Eye, I was like, well, what else has this guy done? And it's Transformers. You write Transformers.
Yeah, I know. Man. It's
is there anything else? Do you have any? I'm sure you have original stories you at least have cooking around. Are there any other franchises that would really excite you to hop onto?
Franchise wise, you know, I would have liked to. Present tense, I would like to do X-Files. I'd like to do mainly TV stuff. I mean, IDW. You know,
sure,
I don't have the license anymore, sadly. But Doctor Who would be fun. It's all rather nostalgic, actually. Like, you know what? There should be. I'm surprised there isn't a Quantum Leap comic. That would be a good. That would be a good comic to write. And then, you know, sort of more in terms of owned characters. You know, Death's Head or Spider-Man. Right. Oh dear, it'd be that end of the. It wouldn't be. I couldn't see myself writing an X-Men comic unless it turned out to be something like the Wolverine and. What was it when Wolverine was a teacher, you know?
Sure, Wolverine
it was,
and the X-Men.
It was Jason Aaron's, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's something like that. Yeah.
2012, I think it was.
Yeah, that type of thing. But really, I didn't have designs on being a comic book writer.
Right.
Really. No, if anything, it was going to be prose, fiction. But, you know, it all worked out all right.
It's pretty okay.
It's okay.
You got a knack for it. those particular franchises, it's interesting that you mentioned, because I think those slot very well into sort of the ways that you do More Than Meets the Eye, which is intimate character moments paired with really impressive plot structures of, you know, this is obviously Doctor Who, there's time travel and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
X-Files has, well, let's tell a story this way about this thing, and it's almost like, you know, the Spark Eater story feels like an X-Files story sometimes.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, X-Files, I think, probably more than I realize, had an influence on me as a storyteller. I mean, let's see, it started in 93, didn't it, X-Files? So I would have been 17 or thereabouts, and I was committed. I saw it through 202 episodes. I was there till it died a death at the end. And yes, okay, went off the ball a bit, but let's be honest, it didn't deliver on a lot of its original promises, you know, in terms of the huge myth arc that it built up.
Sure.
But I remember I was so invested in the story and the way in which information was parceled out so carefully and sparingly, and this intense intrigue to the whole thing. And that's still, I mean, even the story I'm writing now, I still, if I stop and think, I'm thinking, hey, that's like a Chris Carter type, you know, drip of information, or, you know, it's a word that has significance, but you're not quite sure why. Now, the difference is I hope to have learned from some of the mistakes that I made in the X-Files. And so I'm very careful. I do know, unlike the X-Files, bless them, I do know how this ties together and how the big story is going to play out. So that gives me some comfort.
Excellent. But yeah, that comforts me as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that explains a lot, hearing you talk about that. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. There it is. Okay, makes sense. Yeah.
It was, I guess, X-Files, yeah, in terms of the, as I say, the way in which an overarching storyline is pieced together, but just also that sense of the macabre, or that sort of sense of dread when we do a slaughterhouse type story, or the body horror and stuff, or just this, right. I don't know, the conspiratorial side of things, really. So yeah, I guess when you asked me earlier, and I, you know, JLI, Red Dwarf, X-Files, definitely. Yeah,
it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and what a fascinating combination too. Like, that's just it's interesting. I like it. It works though.
That's how I'm going to start selling it to people. It's like JLI meets X Files meets Red Dwarf.
Written by Dan Harmon. Yeah.
Perfect.
So I do have this is just a fun idea I came up with. You don't have to answer this. What is one fun, weird fact about a character or story element, no matter how small the detail, that we don't know that you would be willing to canonize right here and now?
Oh, so invent something that I have to abide by. And, yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, if you've got other questions, I'm going to think about that while I'm answering the other ones, all right? Because that's an exclusive. That's going to be
exactly. That's going to get on CBR tomorrow. we do have a canon question.
Oh yeah, okay.
This was actually something my brother came up with. And God, it's actually from like a year ago, because I was hoping to see you last year at TFCon Charlotte. And so he was asking why Sincere would record Minimus Ambus's death as Ultra Magnus when we see it on Flywheels, on like when he's visiting Flywheels' body. And why did he visit Flywheels 18 months after he was killed?
Right. Okay. So the latter question is probably easier to answer because if they're dead, they're dead, and you know, and it doesn't, the Nukebot doesn't always arrive at the moment of their death.
Okay.
So you know, it's not like they're going to decompose as such. So whether, you know, not like a normal body. So that's okay. So the 18 months isn't, I wouldn't get hung up on that too much.
Okay.
Now, why did he record? Now, the Ultra Magnus thing, when Magnus thought he was going to die at the beginning of Dying of the Light, he did say that he wanted to be buried in his armor, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
So I think, and although he may have made greater strides in terms of sort of separating the two personas, I think, and the Necrobot may well have detected that he was more Ultra Magnus than Minimus Ambus. That was his quote unquote real identity.
Okay.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll take it. Thank you. It was like I said, my brother came up with it and I was like, I will ask him and see what, yeah.
I could have, in hindsight, I could have just not put Ultra Magnus's name on that list.
But then we wouldn't be so concerned. It was concerning.
It needed to be some big names, otherwise you'd think. It's possible those more minor characters could be dead in 18 months or whatever. So, you know.
Sure.
And that was why, by the way, that was why it needed to be 18 months ahead, because it needs to give time for you needed to think, oh God, something awful could happen in the next 18 months, you know, rather than 7 days later. Yeah.
And I just want to say, I Ultra Magnus is very much a favorite character on the show. And the things that you've done with him, you have sort of brought him into being a whole new character, under my impression, is that Minimus Ambus is a invention of these comics, correct?
Yes.
Was that something that you planned for him from the very beginning? Was that something you knew about Ultra Magnus when you walked in? Or did you say, well, what can I do with this guy who's known for being massive and a stickler about rules?
I mean, I knew by the time I sat down to script issue one, I knew where we were going with the Magnus thing. And I think there's I don't know when I think issue six actually is the first clue when Skids says, you know, basically that this isn't the Ultra Magnus I know.
Right. Yeah.
Is X, Y, Z, you know,
right.
Which doesn't, you know, you're not supposed to read anything into that because it's it's written, but,
he's just joking. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And I just, what was it now? I think it may just have been here it is. I try and tell stories where I can that although they're intensely human, the characters, to me the most entertaining Transformers story combines the sort of human element with the alien element, so something which riffs upon them being mechanical or essentially immortal or having a relationship with their bodies which is different to the one we have with ours. Mm-hmm. And again, I guess it goes down to world building and rules. And as a fan, you'd ask yourself, well, how come, you know, why don't they all just build massive hulking bodies for themselves, you know?
Sure,
and thoughts like that, you know, trying to explain that gave rise to things like outliers. So, you know, there is a maximum weight you can carry. Sparks are very useful in that sense, actually, because they're pseudo-scientific, they're mystical in nature, so you can invent these rules for sparks that you can't in other contexts, really. So, you know, outliers and load bearers and stuff like that are concepts invented to make sense of stuff, really, for me. And so I thought, you know, Ultra Magnus, you know, that's a big bot. You know, there could be a smaller one inside. And I swear to God, I didn't make the connection at the time. I didn't think of the toy.
Right, because I was going to say the Magnus armor is a thing. There is a smaller.
And it just didn't. But it's only after the event I thought, oh yeah, got it. So maybe subconsciously it was there. So when I sat down to write the stories, I knew that Magnus was going to be a character. And then there was not just the idea of load bearers, but it was the idea of an immortal sort of lawman, really. We go there occasionally on the mystical side of Transformers, but it was that sort of, you know, this Judge Dredd type figure. That could not be killed.
He commands respect, and you have to, like, and that's, I appreciate that being written, because that's how I always figured Magnus to be, was just like, yeah, like, you know who Ultra Magnus is. He's mess around with him.
Simon, sorry, go on.
Well, no, you're fine. I mean, go ahead.
Just quickly, just because, I mean, Simon Furman sort of defined many aspects of the IDW Ultra Magnus in the spotlight that he wrote. You know, it was Furman that sort of invented the Tyrest Accord and had Magnus as the enforcer and very by the book and things, and as is the case in several of the More Than Meets the Eye characters that sort of had pre-existing identities in the IDW universe, it was a case of sort of turning it up a few notches, yeah, and sort of taking it to the nth degree. And in the context of the other members of the cast, you know, you needed a sort of stern, by the book father. Again, going back to the sitcoms we mentioned, you know, you've got, whether it's, you know, Ron Swanson, or I'm trying to think, actually, who's your, you don't really have one in Community as such, do you?
But not really.
Sometimes Jeff, like, in some seasons, Jeff fills that role.
Exactly. There needs to be a rule, an enforcer of the rules, really,
right,
to impose some order on things. You know?
Right. Well, and even like Brooklyn Nine-Nine,
the
captain is, I see his just alternate, absolutely.
Yeah,
right, absolutely. And then of course Jake is Rodimus, and they're just perfect. And
that was scary to me, because
right, like, I watched it, I was like, this came after More Than Meets the Eye. He was influenced by this.
Well, yeah, because you saw, I know we follow each other on Twitter, and so you would have seen me discovering it about a year ago. And it's scary how the parallels
when you were watching it. Yeah, it's just, it's very spot on.
And we will wrap up here in just a bit. I know that we've taken up a good amount of your time. And this last thing, I may embarrass Nell by bringing it up, but it's very important to me. You mentioned the mystical element of Transformers and the fact that the sparks are sort of magic. They're sort of these supernatural things. I have this theory. I don't think the Transformers are robots. I consider them golems. And I just wanted to get the opinion of someone who would be in the know on this subject.
It's a slight sidestep to your sure. question. We're discouraged from calling them robots in the comics, actually.
There you go.
Why is that the case? I think because this is going back years now, but I think there was a sense that there was a concern that calling them robots would encourage you to think of them as automatons and as sort of, you know, not
sure
having
agency
and free will and things. Yeah. So as a word, it's still avoided in favor of, mechanicals. We've sort of adopted that.
I feel like bots gets used a lot, sure, but like, usually
bots
have the personality. Full term,
bots are cute.
Robot isn't, right.
It's only when words get taken away that you realize how useful. Transform and transformation is another one that we're generally discouraged from using. Yeah, you won't find that many times in the books. But Greg, you're absolutely right.
There you go, everybody. Definitive proof.
There's the exclusive.
I'm going to go ahead and record that sound clip and use it for so many things.
Look what you've done.
Is there anything that you wanted to cover? Is there any message you wanted to get out here?
I should plug Lost Light, really, shouldn't I?
Sure, that would be a sensible idea.
That would make sense. What are we? So, well, okay, we've got... I guess the last ever comic with More Than Meets the Eye on it, which is going to be the Revolution tie-in. So Nick Roach and I tackled that one. Alex draws it. It's the first time the three of us have worked together. Joanna's on colors, so it's sort of it pulls together creators from the last 5 years, really, which is nice and fitting.
Yeah.
That's a fun issue. It's a silly issue. It stars the Scavengers. It's set on Earth.
I am also so excited. That should be fun.
Well, can I give you a detail of that? It includes a scene of the Scavengers giving Crankcase Crankcase is one of the focal characters in that story, and they're giving him tips on how to smarten himself up. Okay, that's
awesome. I love it. It's okay. Adorable.
I got some hints on it at TFCon. Like nothing. I'm still mostly in the dark, but there are a few things that just because of who I was hanging out around, I was like, yeah. Okay, I'm even more excited now.
And then that's out on the 23rd of November. So it's quite a way away. We've missed a month for the first time. There's been at least one More Than Meets the Eye product out every month since January 2012. So this is the first. We've got a gap now. It's been to me, it feels like about a year since Dying of the Light finished.
We're all going.
I think you've earned a month break. Why not?
So Scavengers next month, and then Lost Light issue 1 comes out on the 14th of December. There's 5, if not 6, different covers to it. It's a real, there's something for everyone there. It's an extravaganza. It's as many, or if not more, covers than there were for More Than Meets the Eye 5 years ago. Jack Lawrence makes his Transformers debut. And is brilliant. And in fact, yesterday was when, I mean, I've seen his pencils already. I've seen his inked pages, but yesterday we got the coloured pages through Joanna's on the book, and it looks fantastic. And as I said to you earlier, it's a balancing act, really. It's designed to be welcoming to people that have never picked up the book before. But it's also designed to be a huge bear hug to people that have read the book before.
I like bear hugs. That's good.
You like bear hugs, yeah. because of how Dying of the Light ended, it's very difficult for me to talk too much about what the Lost Light is about. So I will say that we open issue 1 on an entirely new character or characters. Oh. Oh. So it doesn't start off, or hopefully it doesn't start off where you'd expect. And we see some of our old favourites through the eyes of other people. Oh. So that's our way in. That's our way back into the world of More Than Meets the Eye. And it's we start off with a six part story. So it's as long as it's as big as Dying of the Light. Nice. And if you think of it in terms of season 3, then we're just putting a lot of our budget into the first the first big sort of explosive opener.
Kicking it off.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I'm excited.
I'm very excited.
That's
yeah.
the idea. And it's very much the More Than Meets the Eye in spirit. Not least because we talked earlier about how the sort of the accumulation of information, of detail, how a storyline can become richer as you go on. And that's how it's felt to me, really. It feels like, you know, we're literally 5 years into this saga now. In fact, I was thinking today about how, you know, because I was writing the solicitation text for issue 1 and some of the other issues, and you know, they're still on the quest. You know, it's and great yeah. and long, and I love that. But I mean, I'm thinking that's been five years from a reader's perspective. They've been on this submission, and I can't think of many other Transformers storylines in the loosest sense that have endured in that way. So,
it's impressive. Yeah, it's a thing. We have a good thing here.
It's certainly something. But Lost Light, a higher proportion of the stories in the series are going to be feeding into the overall storyline. So there we go. So
well,
please,
I'm,
yes.
I'm very excited. I'm sure it's just 2 or 3 more issues until we find the Knights of Cybertron. Really
Absolutely.
Excited for
We're
that.
We're like almost there. Well, hopefully after we do get to read Lost Light, we can have you on again later and discuss it. And
it would be a pleasure. Yes, please.
Thank you so much for coming on. It was absolutely this was a dream.
Yes,
it was lots of fun. Thank you, and congratulations again on 57 episodes. And I'm sure, like many others, I'm looking forward to your next batch of reviews.
Thank you so
very
much.
Kind of you to say. And before we sign off, I just want to say thank you very, very much to all of our wonderful patrons at patreon.com/soundwav. and we, of course, have all of our Lost Light crew members, which includes good old the Fifth Virtuoso, a new donor here, Kyle Schaefer, Bitty Bot Jazz, Samuel Jacques, Elizabeth Jackalope, as well as our McAdams patrons, David Cabrera and Jay Riley. Thank everybody so much.
Thank you.
And if you ever see James, he officially owes you money now. So just go ahead and demand it from him.
Just ask him.
And thank everybody for sticking with us. Thank you again, James.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And stay tuned for season 2 of Sound.Wave. And I think that'll do it for us. See you next week. Transformanauts, what are you up to?
Transformanauts, I think they all had a good time at TFCon.
I think they're all still resting and recovering. They're all snuggled up under these blankets.
There's some napping happening.